Hey, I'm Nancy Wilson.
Mike Campbell.
Mark Mothersbaugh from Devo.
Hey, it's Adam from Counting Crows, and I am here giving you the story behind the song.
The story behind the song is back for season four. I'm Peter Chidi of Deep Cuts Media, and this season we're diving even deeper into some of music history's most iconic tracks with the legends who made them.
What's so beautiful about it is a lot of people connect with, you gotta live your life and don't let the big man push you down. Don't have to live like a refugee, can't keep fighting for what you believe. And that was Tom.
From the spark of inspiration to untold tales from the studio, we unlock the true stories that shape the music you love.
At the time on the radio, there was a really cool riff by Nazareth covering a Joni Mitchell song, This Flight Tonight. It had the same groove, but I think Barracuda kind of blew it out of the water.
Join us as we all sit down with music icons like Devo, Heart, Mike Campbell of Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, Sublime, Counting Crows, and so many more. New episodes are out now from the Consequence Podcast Network, so tune in wherever you get your podcasts and join me for the story behind the song.
To find out what's really going on behind the music, sometimes you have to dig deep. I'm Dr. Mike, and on the new season of Going There, we're doing just that.
Art or music can be your escape and your therapy.
Going There is the podcast at the crossroads of music and mental health, where we have raw, meaningful conversations with artists like Noah Kahan, Julian Baker, Jason Isbell, Youngblood, The Head and the Heart, and Bishop Briggs.
I recently heard someone describe grief as glitter, where you'll clean it up, and then you'll find little pieces.
By opening ourselves up to these real discussions about mental health, we can foster understanding and gain even greater appreciation for the music we all love.
For me, like, my favorite songs give me happy tears.
So join me and some of your favorite artists on the new season of Going There with Dr. Mike, brought to you by SoundMind Live and the Consequence Podcast Network. Subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts.
I'm Leo Phillips, host of This Must Be The Gig. We're a weekly podcast that documents everything about the world of live music. Speaking with choreographers, costume and set designers, the people who run beloved venues and festivals, and, of course, speaking with musicians about that one gig that changed their lives. Get your peek behind the curtain at consequenceofsound.net, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Consequence Podcast Network.
And welcome to another edition of Kyle Meredith With. It's an interview series presented by WFPK Independent Louisville at WFPK.org at Consequence of Sound and the Consequence Podcast Network. Put out interviews multiple times a week, and if you're not already a subscriber, I hope you do hit that subscribe button. Whether you're listening at iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or anywhere else you get your favorite podcast from, you can subscribe. If you're already a subscriber, hey, thanks. Glad to have you along. Maybe give us a hi, hello, wherever you're listening from in the comments section or the review section. Of course, you can also rate the series as well. I'm Kyle Meredith. Today's a very special episode. I have been talking with the band Dawes just about since when they got started, which was 10 years ago. This year marks the 10th anniversary of the band Dawes. Last year, they released a brand new record called Passwords. And just a few weeks ago at the Forecastle Festival, I caught up with Taylor Goldsmith once again to talk about the record. So I'm going to play that interview first. It's a shorty. So what I've decided to do is include the entire history, my history with Dawes. Throughout the course of this episode, you're also going to hear 2017's We're All Gonna Die, 2015's All Your Favorite Bands, 2013's Stories Don't End, 2012's Nothing Is Wrong, and we'll even get a little bonus interview for when Taylor Goldsmith was in the band Middle Brother. But we're going to start with the present. Again, recorded at Forecastle 2019 right here in Louisville, Kentucky. It's part one of Kyle Meredith with Dawes.
Thanks for having me.
No, man, it's so great. I know it's been, I mean, you come to Louisville a lot, but it's been a minute now.
Yeah, this is like probably the biggest window, biggest gap between our Louisville visits.
We noticed.
And it's weird. I mean, we're on tour all the time too, so maybe for most bands this would still be kind of quick, but
for my house band for a bit. So let's see what is going on, because, you know, Passwords is a year old now.
Yeah.
just had its first birthday.
Yeah.
Yeah. So is this the between album spot? Is that where we are?
Yeah, I mean, like we're visiting places we didn't on the actual record cycle. I mean, sometimes I wonder if it would behoove us professionally to just like stop for like 10 minutes, but that's just never been the way we like to live our lives and be in a band. So we're booked through the rest of this year, and we found a little bit of time to make a record, so we're all ready to go to release the next one. I'm sure that won't be for a little while, but yeah, we can't seem to calm down.
Yeah, isn't that the worst part though? Like the record's done yeah. or whatever, and maybe it's going to be, you know, 6-9 months before it yeah. comes out. Yeah. So by the time you get to that, you're talking about something that yeah. you know is what, a year and a half old.
Yeah, which hopefully like. Gives me a chance to get a little ahead
yeah.
to write a few more new songs for the one after that, but that never works out. I always just end up waiting for this one to catch up, and then I don't write a song for a year, and that's typically my rhythm.
It's been interesting because the last couple records, it seems like you all have been in the reinvention, you know, adventurous stage, right. you know, trying out new things. Is that still, you know,
this
what's
one,
going on?
No, this one, I mean, well, I like to think that every record, there's aspects of it where we try to push ourselves, whether that's sonically or just as a songwriter or the way that we play our instruments in a more fundamental sense, whether that's guitar, drums, or keyboards, or bass. This one's a very live record. This will be probably closest to something like All Your Favorite Bands, where it's just like us live in a room. The vocals are all happening right on the floor. The solos, everything is just kind of happening right there. I'm excited for there to be another Dawes record like that. It's funny because like our like adventurous phases or trying new things, like we never perceive them as such. For us, we go into every record with this mindset of let's do things that make us smile or make us feel excited. And on certain records, that means different things. It doesn't hit us till after the fact that oh, this is going to be very different for people.
Right.
Like for us, it's always the same objective. And maybe that sounds weird to say that after the fact, but that's really all that's ever going on.
Yeah. Well, it's also interesting because how long has Dawes been around now?
I mean, 10.
It's 10 years, right?
Yeah.
10 years.
Yeah.
And that's usually like a big moment for a band to try to figure out like yeah. what do we do now or something
yeah.
like that, but I never got that sense that there's been like that oh no moments, you know, or that take pause
yeah.
moments.
Yeah, and I mean I think it's almost because of we've been a smaller band, I guess, like we've never been this massive band, and I think that's served us well in terms of our creative spirit. Mm-hmm. It's always made us feel like, oh, we gotta click it over, we gotta get to this hump and then sell this many tickets and yada yada yada, and so it's kept us feeling really young. Like I feel like I don't know if we're perceived as such by fans, but I always looked at us as like this, the young band, still the underdog that still isn't quite graduated.
Yeah.
And I love that.
You still look as young as when we first met 10 years ago.
Sweet.
It's that LA sun right there. I
yeah,
know it
yeah.
is. I know what that does make it is this gets to be a greatest hits tour. And I think that's
exactly.
the fun one for a fan, you know, for something
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, whenever
this,
we're not, like, we're after a record cycle and or before one, it's less about pushing a new album, and it's more about celebrating the whole catalog.
Yeah. Taylor Goldsmith of Dawes, the newest record, again, is called Passwords. As they work ahead to the next one there as well. And that interview recorded at the Forecastle Festival 2019 edition in the Tiny House studio for the Tiny House Sessions. There's also a video of that, which you can find on the WFPK Facebook page. Now, before this, the previous time we had talked was in 2017, staying pretty much on what ended up being our 2-year rule. We have talked every 2 years since we met. 2017, they had just released the record, We're All Gonna Die, and then the follow-up live album that came along with it, We're All Gonna Live, or We're All Gonna Live, whichever way you'd prefer to say that. So it's part two of Kyle Meredith with Dawes.
Hey, buddy.
Hey, man. How's it going?
I'm all right. How are you?
I'm pretty good.
Good to talk to you. It's been a little bit.
Yeah, it sure has. I feel like the last time we were sitting down across from each other in the studio.
We were. Yeah, we did I guess it was the last record. In fact, I was kind of I was laughing as I went back and just kind of skimmed it for what we were talking about then, and it was funny because back then you and I were talking about dating and how you just didn't think that it was going to work out for you.
Oh, well, I guess things have changed a little bit.
Things have changed. We're really excited to have Dawes back in Louisville, April 21st. You're playing the Brown Theater. It's going to be good to have you guys back here.
Behind
behind a new record that, of course, everyone loves saying on the air, too, with We're All Gonna Die. You've made it really fun for the DJs. That's what you've done.
I'm glad you see it that way, because some people were like, isn't that a tad morbid? So to us, it was always kind of, I mean, obviously, we don't want to downplay our own thing, something like mortality, but at the same time, I do feel like it has a certain ridiculousness to it that we hope to make it fun.
Yeah. Well, I've heard you talk about it in the other interviews about, you know, when you have that mantra, it sort of takes the pressure off, like the old adage of don't sweat the small things, or, you know, something like that.
Yeah, and that's really, it's just a different way of saying that. I guess the most effective one for my own trip is trying to be mindful of that, especially when we do something as sort of that is impressionistic and lofty as making music.
I've started using it just for everything. If I want to get out of a situation, any situation, you know, just turn around and be like, you know what, we're all going to die.
Right. So how can someone hold a grudge? Right.
I feel like personally, though, it's probably taken on a new meaning with everything that's been happening out around the world lately. And I know it's no means a political statement or anything, but again, kind of using it in a new context.
And it wasn't lost on us. I mean, the album came out at the beginning of a pretty intense presidential election. So no matter what side you sat on with all that, I feel like a phrase like that, whether or not attached to music by Dawes or otherwise, seemed to have a particular resonance all throughout 2016.
Well, I was kind of looking at it, and so a few weeks ago, I was talking with Guy Garvey from the band Elbow, and I'd mentioned how it seems like everybody I talk to is writing some sort of either a political record or a reflective record or something like that, and he wasn't, and I said, oh, it's because you fell in love and you were in a love bubble. And so none of this has penetrated you. And I was wondering, it was like, maybe it was sort of the same thing for you.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that was a big part of my year last year. And in a way, even though, you know, I look at some of our records and there'll be like, you know, entire sides of an album or something that's pretty close to dealing with the same thing. And I look at so many of my favorite albums, and while some are examples of that, like something like Blood on the Tracks, which seems very much like a record about a relationship falling apart, for the most part, I really like when a songwriter is able to kind of cover more ground. Mm-hmm. and discuss things beyond their, you know, their romantic life. Because then when they do go to that, it becomes that much more heavy. Like a record like by a guy like Warren Zevon or John Prine, these guys that can take these more global approaches or these broader views, or talk about things that seem so, in some cases, off limits for songwriters. And then to be able to bring it back around to songs like, you know, French Inhaler or Far From Me, and then I feel like your heart is thus like that much more broken. And so with We're All Gonna Die, despite it being a product of feeling in love and that being becoming a big part of my life, that it's strange. Like it really shed a lot of light on what it means to be a writer. There's a Philip Ross quote saying, like, you know, don't marry a writer because they're voyeuristic and indiscreet, and that applies for songwriters too. And I feel like anything that was happening in my life before my new relationship with Mandy, it was sort of a game, and it didn't matter who got hurt or whose laundry got aired. I mean, I tried to be fair-minded when I would write these songs, but if something was going on in my personal life, that for all I cared, it was going on in my musical life as well.
Right.
And then this was the first time where it's like, oh, I wanna learn to be the kind of writer that can probe those depths and get to the bottom of things without putting myself on blast, without taking things that are sacred in my life and just sharing them without me considering the reason for it. I think that's a big part of the whole writing trip. That is something that I've tried to be mindful of as I've gotten older, where sometimes it's so easy to just pick up a guitar and talk about how bummed you are, how she broke your heart, or how you're a victim of something, and then leave it at that. And that's going to work. That's going to affect some people.
Yeah.
But I feel like to go to those places and then to offer something at the end of it, to try to to try to say, and here's why I'm talking about this with you. That's the real, those are the real badass.
I mean, you've always been a great writer, and I know that's kind of one of the things for any creative person is after a while, you know, you want to strive for something else. I mean, nobody wants to get stagnant and to switch it up and find a new formula. Or at least a bit of a new direction of how to do it. You know, I know that's got to be part of the conversation. So,
yeah, I mean, that's and also like a lot of people talk about these examples of artists doing that. And they say, like whether it's the Stones going from, you know, early Satisfaction type rock and roll songs all the way to, you know, Some Girls and Tattoo You and Paul Simon going from Simon and Garfunkel to Graceland or the Beatles doing what they did. I mean, it's not only common, but it's essential is the way I like to look at it. Mm-hmm. For an artist to continue to challenge themselves, or else they won't stay in the conversation. I feel like if Bob Dylan made those first four records and of protest songs, more or less, and then continued to write in that same voice, and he was always having the acoustic guitar and the harmonica, and that was it, then I feel like he would have gone the way of other amazing writers like, you know, Phil Ochs or something, where you don't really talk about them. But the fact that he was able to change his voice, change his approach, change the presentation, it has kept him in the conversation for this long. And I'm not saying that, like, we now Dawes has found a way to stay relevant. I don't really feel like we've ever been particularly relevant, but I feel like at least for us to feel rejuvenated and fresh and excited, it requires us to not say that worked before, let's just do it again, because mm-hmm. I feel like that would like depress us very fast.
And I know that's been a big part of the story on this record too, is that it does have a different sound. And while I've also read that you guys didn't specifically go for the sound, you know, in the way it happened, I guess that had to be on your mind though, that you had to do something to shake it up.
I guess like the things that were kind of, intentional is a weird word, but things that were, I guess, part of just the plan without us thinking it was going to create some drastically different result was more in the approach, you know, like I feel like after making All Your Favorite Bands, we had made this record that as close as we could, we represented what we can do on a stage as a band and how we interact, you know, whether it's the drums and the guitar during a guitar solo or the way I play guitar and the way I sing at the same time. Like all this stuff was like, yeah, that's what we do. That's what we've always done. And this is our best. We've always wanted to really capture that in a recording. And this is the best we could have done at mm-hmm. that. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people ask, like, cool, so does that mean you're going to make records like this from now on? And the answer is, of course not. And so the same way that Stories Don't End led us to All Your Favorite Bands, without us, like, again, there was no, like, mission statement. It was really just like, oh, you know, like, playing the guitar while I sing the vocal sounds fun. I don't know if that's going to, like, come off as some philosophical shift for the band. That's just what I want to do. And with this one, you know, we had this new keyboardist, Lee Pardini, mm-hmm. and with the record that we made, I wrote these songs and sort of thought, you know, I played a lot of guitar and it was a blast, and now it's exciting to kind of hold this acoustic guitar and see what the band does around it. And so certain songs ended up with really cool keyboard breaks or really cool, you know, string breaks in a song like We're All Gonna Die, or just no solo at all. And so I feel like by me stepping back as a guitarist, it opened up the playing field to really featuring, you know, the keyboards and the bass and elements of this band that have always been there, but maybe haven't gotten a chance to really present themselves. So I really dig that what, you know, what We're All Gonna Die became, it was organic. Yeah. And, you know, that's not to say that, like, I listen to all of our records and think, like, I can't hear the difference. Of course they sound different to me. But, like, you know, to me, We're All Gonna Die sounds different than anything that came before it, the same way that, you know, Nothing Is Wrong sounds different than any of our other records, or All Your Favorite Band sounds different than any of our other records. Mm-hmm. But I like to believe that rather than abandoning the identity that they've all kind of helped arrange and prop up, it's sort of embracing it and just trying to find another side of it. You see, hear so many stories of bands that, like, they hate their own music or their own past as a band, and they won't play any of their older material, and they only play the new record. Like, that's really not the case with us. You know, we still I mean, obviously we'd make changes on any of our records if given the chance, but we still love all of the music, and we love that it's sort of, they're all representative of what we do. And as time goes on, that sort of identity kind of continues to expand.
And there's so many great things to compliment on this record, too. I mean, the looseness, especially in the piano, which is a nice contrast, because when, you know, you're working with some electronic sounds like you guys did, you don't expect to have a looseness there, and you guys were able to balance that. And I love the way the piano plays with the bass on Less Than 5 Miles Away, and even how the title track is almost like a soft rock song, which is a perfect contradiction to the title, you know?
Yeah. No, thanks for saying that. And that was a big part of what we were going for. Like with this, I feel like this record was the first time where we've started to explore the relationship between the lyric and the music itself. Mm-hmm. You know, certain decisions like having girls saying, "Oh man, can you picture it?" And they can potentially, depending on how you listen to it, can kind of create this sort of mocking tone. You know, it's not a coincidence that that's sung by women. For a song called "Picture of a Man," where this guy is kind of going down this road of like discussing with himself how he feels about himself as a man in this world, yeah. And then a song like "We're All Gonna Die," like along with what you're saying, like we wanted to take this lyric and this title, "We're All Gonna Die," and try to create the most beautiful track on the album, and try to, you know, arrange it so by the end there's these strings and these melodies, while there's a cascading vocal of all of us singing "We're All Gonna Die" over on top of each other. And the juxtaposition of that was something that was at the very least funny to us, if not, you know, something more.
Right. You brought up Picture of a Man. You know, that's sort of a theme that you played with around on previous records, too, like this idea of manhood. You know, it's not the first time that you've went there, and I was sort of curious about, you know, if that's been realized with you as well.
That's a cool question. I mean, yeah, like with certain songs, like "Coming Back to a Man" or "If I Wanted Someone," mm-hmm. that was definitely a subject that I've gone to. I guess I've never really thought about it, but it's for sure the case. I mean, you know, even when I wrote a song like "If I Wanted Someone," I got nervous that it was going to come across the wrong way. If that song's about anything, there's a line in the verse that says, "While you lean into the echoes, without raising a hand, like, oh woman, help me see it like it is." Like, mm-hmm. if anything, it defers to a female perspective, and it's an admission of these bumbling guys can just kind of often fall short, and I don't know, at least in my case, like the true spirit of female guidance is actually the key to feeling okay with everything. Yeah. And "Picture of a Man" is along those lines, where it's you know, there's, I think there's such a funny duality to a man's kind of trip in this world where there's almost this unspoken requirement for this sort of bravado.
What it means to be a man that you've used before too. Like,
But at the same time, like the reality is we're riddled with insecurities, and we probably have less of an idea as to what's going on than most people in the room. And so I think that, I guess, at least that's my own experience. So I guess that juxtaposition is something that I've always kind of wrestled with a little bit. And yeah, I guess it's popping up yet again.
Yeah, it's a cool theme. I don't know that a lot of people's tackling it the way you do. And I'll wrap up by saying that as a compliment to all of your songs, you always take such a unique perspective on your storytelling that, you know, we can't help but sit and listen and pay attention. And I love it. And I love this record as much as I've loved any of your records.
Thank you.
It was really great talking to you today. Again, Dawes, April 21st at the Brown Theater. I can't wait to see you guys here very soon.
Yeah, man. I'm looking forward to seeing you.
All right, dude. Well, take care, and we'll see you.
All right. See you soon.
All right. Bye.
Once again, Taylor Goldsmith there talking about 2016's "We're All Gonna Die," 2017's "We're All Gonna Live" live album, and then pushing right along. It was 2 years prior to that. All your favorite bands came out in 2015, and no sense giving too much setup here. Part three. Kyle Meredith with Dawes.
Dawes with the new record, All Your Favorite Bands, number four. Record
yep.
number four.
Yep.
So now you're legitimate. That's what this is. You're legitimized.
Right. Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, it's funny. I was actually thinking about this the other day, how you know, in any review or any sort of thing that I read, article about this record or about this band, they still talk about young band from LA, you know, new band from LA. And I really love that because I feel like a lot of bands on their fourth record or something, you might be like, oh, yeah, well, then they've been around forever
You can technically release a greatest hits after three records.
Right.
It's not advised, but some people do it, you know. And what they always make the same mistake, by the way. They call it volume one.
Right. Like, yeah, you're not having another one.
That's it. Yeah. If you're releasing the greatest hits after three, you're done. There's a reason why your label is pushing you to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, so I think it's awesome that people still see us as like the young kids in on the block, which is cool for us.
It is, I guess, an anomaly. I mean, that not every band gets that.
Yeah, like when you think, and you know, great bands, you think of like Arcade Fire or Band of Horses or something, yeah. And they're three or four records deep, and I realize their level of success is astronomical compared to ours. But people are like, oh yeah, well these are like well-established bands that are well into their careers.
While you guys could technically still get Best New Artist at the Grammys.
Right. And I think that's so cool.
Do you ever think of yourself, by the way, in the greatest hits sort of thing? Like, do you ever think of your catalog in that way?
Like, I do in terms of, like, when you go see a Tom Petty set,
yeah,
there's maybe, like, a deep cut or two.
But you're getting the jukebox.
You're getting the hits, yeah, right. And it's so satisfying. Yeah. We're not really a band with the hits, but we do have, you know, the flagship songs of each record, the three or four songs. And it's fun to just play those and then, you know, always rep whatever the new record is. Like on our sets right now, we have, you know, we're playing seven or eight songs from the new album.
Is almost the entire new album.
Yeah, which is almost the whole thing. And then especially if you play the last song, which makes up like a third of
right.
it. And then we just do the two or three main songs from each of the rest of the records, and it just feels like a really good set. Like, oh, this feels, I don't know if we would call it our best of or our greatest hits, but it's really good to watch an audience respond to that.
And then you have some bands like Sonic Youth, who will basically only stick to the new record. Like 30 years in, they're still only playing the new record with like one song at the very end. It's like such a different thing.
Right.
Well, anyway, congratulations on this record because it's another great one. It's a beautiful record. The lyrics are outstanding. I don't know how you can continuously do that as a songwriter to really... I was listening earlier and I realized you have so many words.
Yeah, there's a lot of words sometimes.
Yeah, and I don't mean that like, you know, you're not spitting rhymes or anything like that. But your what do you call it? Your lexicon is quite big for a song, you know, songwriter, I guess.
Right. Yeah, I don't know what that is. I've always it's always never felt done. I've always felt like I had to write more and more. And sometimes maybe you know I'm shooting myself in the foot, like a song like Somewhere Along the Way. It could have been easy enough to just write one chorus and then be like, okay, that's the chorus. But instead, for some reason, I felt compelled to write a different chorus every time that lyric Somewhere Along the Way came around, and I thought it made it better. It might just make it more chewy and challenging or something. I don't know. Or like on our third record, there's a song Just Beneath the Surface that I just kept writing and writing and writing that eventually we decided we're going to cut this into two songs. And that's why it sort of bookends the record. But originally it was just one really long song.
Yeah. I guess I love that you do it that way. You know, the compliments there.
Thanks.
And I heard this one friend, I guess, tell me at one point that if you've only got one line to repeat over and over and over, you don't have much to say. And I don't think that's true for every example, because sometimes you're just trying to drive a point home and everything. But when you're doing it kind of like this, it's you do have something to say. It's kind of proving that point. There's more to this story than just, you know.
Yeah, and that's always been one of my favorite things, not only about songwriting, but just about songs that I'm listening to, is when a songwriter is able to bring you into a situation and then force you to look at it from a different perspective, you know, like any good work of art, where you have to, that could be a reality too. And that can be a perspective as well. And then by the time you walk away from a situation, you're not just looking at from, you know, one person's shoes, but you're kind of seeing a bigger, more universal experience.
Right. And as a fan, it gives us so much more to dig into.
Right. You know, hopefully,
just to keep coming out of that. Did you guys? I saw a picture. Did you guys go to the Bahamas?
We did go to the Bahamas
for rehearsals.
They weren't for rehearsals, although okay. I wish that's the kind of band that we were.
That's a great picture, by the way. Here we are in front of our plane, headed to the Bahamas.
We ended up playing someone's birthday. Some fan of the band that wanted us to fly to his birthday, and he put us on. He chartered this plane, and we'd never done anything like that.
Yeah.
It was hilarious. But so we and it was it, in a way it was rehearsals. It was one of the It was one of the last times we played a lot of these new songs before, you know, starting this tour.
Right.
But yeah, it was great. It was a good way to kind of reset before heading out for a long time. We all were on jet skis and jumping off cliffs and, you know.
Exactly what I want to hear about when you're like, I don't want to just hear that you flew down there and played a birthday party and then came home. Like, I want to hear the Rolling Stones story and all of that stuff at the time we spent on the islands.
Yeah, it was very, it was as, you know, as rock star as we could be, but also, I mean, as the operative phrase being as much as we could be.
Right.
There was also a lot of just NBA finals and sitting around.
you can't miss it.
Yeah, exactly.
But I guess this whole thing is what I'm grasping is here. The whole setup for this one has been different, and it's been talked about how you guys did the pre-production live in front of everyone, mm-hmm. and you took it around. But it's what I see is the routine of routine when you're album number four. And it's all kind of set of how you do things, and this is the setup, and this is it seems like you guys pushing against that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I think even if it's just for the sake of ourselves and our own experience doing this stuff, you got to find ways to keep it interesting and to keep it fresh. I mean, you know, you look at these artists with these breakout albums, and there's always some sort of narrative, whether that's within the context of the material or if it's in the way a record was made. Or if something as simple as a producer chosen, or a band member replaced, or whatever those stories are. And for us, you know, if we just kind of did what we've always done, and you know, churned out another record, and you know, gave you know guys like you and me nothing to talk about, it just wouldn't be as exciting for us. And I, you know, because people are going to say whatever they want to say about it, but. For us to be able to say, yeah, we made this record this way, this record this way, this record this way. It keeps each record with its own fingerprint, with its own identity. And, you know, with Stories Don't End, we consciously didn't play songs in front of people. Mm. And that, I really like how that informed what that record ended up being. And with this record, it was something where let's make sure this record could stand up on its own two legs with just the four of us.
Yeah.
And so we went out on tour and played 2 weeks worth of shows in small towns in California to make sure that was possible. And that was a blast because Dave, our producer, Dave Rawlings, he came on the tour with us, and he would stand out in the audience, kind of watch how people would react.
Right.
We would sound checks would be spent reworking stuff. And then after each show, we'd all kind of run backstage and kind of get back in the huddle. It was like having a coach. And it was really cool because we would do little shifts here and there. Like, why don't you put the solo after the bridge tonight?
Right.
And then so we would do that, and like, okay, that did this. And then we would put it before the bridge, and then all of a sudden we'd be like, woo! And they're like, oh wow, people are responding. Maybe they don't even know why.
It's a different way to do songwriting, right?
But
there.
But yeah, you know, it's just like
it's almost giving something up too. It's like I'm kind of giving up a little bit of my craft.
Yeah.
You know, too.
And I think that you have to eventually, if you're going to stay productive,
right.
if you're going to continue to put out material regularly, you have to trust the material and you have to trust the way that it comes out. If we were to get overly precious about it, we just wouldn't release that many records.
Yeah.
And I know we only have four, but you know, we were already like seven songs into the next one.
Wow.
At least in terms of like writing. And
so that's it. I never get the sense, and I'm sure it's complete perception, that you take too much downtime.
Yeah, not really.
And maybe it's because, you know, you had the New Basement tapes and that was in there. There was a Laura Marling line about why she took 2 years between records instead of her year and a half, because she just pumps them out there. And she's like, she got in this, her own routine, where she would force herself to live so she could have something to write about.
Right.
But when I look at you, it's like, I don't even see where you have that time. I don't see, like, you write a lot of love songs,
right.
More or less. It's like, when does he have the time to have relationships?
It's true. Actually, I've been thinking about that myself. But I do, I think, I mean, I don't know. I think that we've always felt most alive and most happy when we're touring. I think, you know, obviously a lot of the guys have you know, beautiful girlfriends in their lives and they're out on tour with us quite a bit. And, I'm hoping to figure that out for myself someday. Who knows? Maybe not. But,
it's a lot more pressure when you're the singer too. It's like, it's a lot more vetting. I would say.
And also, you know, it's just the simple thing of if we go home for 2 weeks, these guys are such hard workers and they practice and everything, but you know, like their workload is a different thing. If we go home for 2 weeks for me, and they would say the same thing, but it's like, okay, maybe I can get a song. Maybe I can get two songs.
Right.
I don't know how to not work.
Yeah.
I've always felt that way. Even if I'm, told by, you know, all friends and family and people we work with, like, just take this month and do nothing. Yeah. Just hang out with your friends and do nothing. I'm still in the back of my head, like, what song could I write? Like, what could I get ready for this next thing? It's just how I've always been wired.
What's that all, the thing people say, you get to love what you do and you get paid for it. Like, you're going to be doing that regardless so that you have that passion, you keep going. But, okay, so with the way you write, though, and here you're talking about, like, I've got to get that whole personal life thing straightened out. Where do you go when you're looking for those lyrics? Is it character based, or do you still find the time to have broken relationships throughout the year?
There was one that just really did a number on me, so I'm able to just.
You got a few albums in that.
Yeah,
one.
Yeah, sure did. Yeah, she's a lot of songs, and it's all good. We're pals and everything, but in a sense, a lot of it's personal, and then a lot of it's not. Like, a lot of it's very much exaggerated. Mm-hmm. Like a song off the new record, like Somewhere Along the Way. That's way far beyond anything I've ever experienced. That paints a picture of someone who I wouldn't want to spend any time around. Mm-hmm. Although maybe would be fascinating for 10 minutes. But there's a lot of exaggeration. There's a lot of stuff that's not me, you know, especially on earlier songs where, or like Little Bit of Everything or something, or Bear Witness, where it's just clearly not experiences I've had.
Right.
And I think that's, at least for my trip as a songwriter, I think that's important to chase down, because you do look at a lot of songwriters that use themselves as sort of a science project, and they sort of dig in and they just kind of figure out like where it really hurts and then just try to draw that out
just so they can have the art.
Then you look at them after a lifetime's worth of a career and they're pretty beat up,
right?
At their own hand, you know, and I don't, like anybody else, I don't want to have a job that's not going to make me happy.
Right.
And my job does make me really happy, and I think that it's important for me to strike that balance of like, yeah, maybe it's not the most romantic story. Maybe I'm not some heartbroken drug addict that
you bleed for your art by continuously working on it.
Yeah.
Not so much having to literally bleed for your art.
Right. Right.
You know?
And you look at a lot of artists that have these careers where they've devoted themselves to this one thing.
Yeah.
And it's so profound when looking back on it, like, you know, Woody Allen or something.
Sure.
Like, if you were to just show someone one Woody Allen movie, although it can be one of the greatest movies you've ever seen, obviously, once you realize the body of work and the constant commitment, it doesn't matter that he might have just been some guy that, like, you know, was, you know, not necessarily troubled, or I don't know what his life was like, but if he was just some guy that was like, yeah, I like writing and I make these movies, all that stuff is, it doesn't matter, because he has 40 years worth of movies
that
he's
made. Some people are just less human in that way.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm not discounting his humanness or anything like that, but when you look at it from this side, it's like,
yeah. And then
I really like doing things too. I'm very passionate about things, but I don't think even my highest passions will ever reach that level of being able to pull them off.
That's, you know? Another, you have to, I don't know, you just live on a different planet when you're able to access creativity on such a regular basis.
Makes me a little bit envious.
Oh yeah. And there's a lot of people like that. Like when we did the Basement Tapes thing, that was something that I really witnessed in Elvis Costello. Mm-hmm.
I mean,
all those guys are so...
continuously puts it out like that.
Yeah.
And so many different things. And
like he has 30-something records. He has almost as many records as Bob Dylan, and his first one didn't come out till like 12 years after Dylan's first, or even more, I think. Yeah. And when we were working on some of those Dylan lyrics, there would be some pieces of paper where it would just be two stanzas, and Elvis would, like, oh, we need more lyrics. And then I would kind of like... take a drink of water and turn around, and Elvis would, and it'd be like, it'd be completed. And
You ever just want to just give him the finger, yeah. right?
Yeah, I mean, it was so crazy to see, yeah. and then that was one of those like, oh, that's what the Men from the Boys looks like moments, yeah,
right,
you know,
right.
And all those people that were involved in that are so creative. You know, Jim, everyone was just, it can just, music pours out of them.
Oh, it's amazing.
But with
group.
Elvis, yeah. there's just this other thing of like, I've heard stories of when he said, oh, I want to make this record with this producer and this band. And they said, cool, when do you want to start? And like, oh, I don't have any songs written. So what do you say? 2 weeks. So he can call upon it like the Woody Allens, like yeah. whoever, so fast. And that's, I think the dream, at least for me, to be able to get to that creative place where, you're the there's so much material coming out of you, and obviously you want it to be quality, yeah. but
if you're writing that much, I mean, there's a rule of odds things that comes into it,
yeah.
So if you're writing that much, there's going to be gems,
mm-hmm. absolutely
know, they're going to be there, and then you can start looking at your greatest hits catalog,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
and it all makes sense,
and then you look volume four,
right? I did want to get one other take on your experience with this. So you worked with Dave Rawlings, you had mentioned that you did it in Nashville.
Mm-hmm.
How conscious are you of the two worlds of Nashville? And because what you guys play, whether you categorize it as Americana or folk rock or whatever it is, it that you can bridge it to country music.
Mm-hmm.
Like there is a bridge there. And here you are working in Nashville with a guy who is very un-Nashville
right.
in that sense.
Right.
You know, is there ever that, do you see that world as you're kind of interacting in it? And does it ever, when you look at that, do you go, how is that songwriting you
right,
know,
right.
versus what I'm doing?
Right. Do you mean sort of like the
Vegas, pop Nashville?
Like
yeah, all of
yeah.
that. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a bummer. And I mean, I'm not as familiar with that stuff as a lot of other people that have lived there. Like I've listened to interviews with, you know, Jason Isbell and stuff, yeah. and to hear him just kind of take those people out to task.
Isbell ain't scared.
Yeah, it's great. And it's so, and he's always dead on about
yeah.
it. And he's like, you know, but this person has some good songs, this person
right.
does not. and I've kind of always kept blinders on
yeah.
with that part of Nashville. I don't watch the Grammys. I can't handle that. I have learned a long time ago that the music that I make, that we make as Dawes, mm-hmm. appeals to a small fraction of music fans. And we are so lucky in this day and age to have one of them, let alone enough to stay on tour and put out records. But if I start paying close attention to the top of the country charts and top, you know, and watching the Grammys, I'll just want to quit.
That is actually an Isbell line that says the more shitty music that you listen to, the more shitty music that you'll produce.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I just have to pretend that everyone still knows every word of Visions of Joanna,
right.
and that everyone still sits at home memorizing Songs of Love and Hate by Leonard Cohen.
Yeah.
I know that's not true, but that's the kind of music fan that I want to be, and so that's the kind of music fan that I want to play to, and I'm not going to cater to anything else. And Dave is very much like that. Mm-hmm. Dave is, you know, I mean, you know, you think of those records that him and Gil made, mm-hmm. they're obviously not playing by anybody's rules mm-hmm. except their own. And so to be around a guy like that was so good for us, because, you know, I think I realize that we are a hard band to place in one particular category, which I guess is a good way to be, but it's not like, you know, we're not necessarily...
It's like all rock.
Yeah,
know?
It's rock and roll,
rock.
And that's how we
yeah.
describe it, but some people would say, like, well, you know, like maybe the indie kids would say, well, no, they're an Americana mm-hmm. band, they don't belong with us, and maybe the Americana kids would be like, no, they're not
right,
this,
right.
they're that. I don't know, but I do know that you know, in those sorts of questions, it was really great to have a guy like Dave. I remember certain conversations where he would say, we are so lucky to not have to play the relevance game.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Gillian and him are great examples of not being relevant. And I'm sure he would say the same thing.
Yeah. Years,
and
they're
legendary
yeah.
in their way and for what they do. And they always will be. They
yeah.
cannot put out another record for another 8 years, and it will be an event,
yeah.
and it will be great. And if they were to try to, oh, well, this is popular now, maybe we should try to get that kind of guitar sound or that kind of keyboard sound or anything like that, I feel like that just wouldn't work for why we all love them. And
you turn into Aerosmith.
Right, right. Just trying to stay relevant. Right. And then you hear these, like, you know, you hear about U2 complaining that no one likes Songs of Innocence. It's like, well, the fact that you're complaining about,
look,
like,
what you did.
Yeah.
That's a whole other interview.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that yeah. And so for us, I don't know what our next records are going to sound like. I hope they all sound as, you know, different as they possibly can, but always natural to who we are. But I don't think we're ever going to play that game of, oh, well, this is going on in contemporary music, so let's try to keep an eye on that as well. We've just never been good at that, nor do we want to be.
Al Taylor, I think it's very important that you're doing that. I think it's important that you live in a world where everybody knows every word of Visions of Johanna. And congratulations on all your favorite bands, the new Dawes record.
Right,
it's great to talk to you, and we'll see you next time.
Yeah.
All right.
And again, that one goes back to 2015's All Your Favorite Bands with a title track that has become a fan favorite classic. All right, two more years in the past. Head back to 2013 now. That's when Dawes released Stories Don't End, part four of Kyle Meredith with Dawes.
It's the Weekly Feed live at South by Southwest in Austin, Texas. I'm Kyle Meredith, and standing next to me is the band Dawes. How about this, huh? So excited to see everything you guys have done. Album number three now, Stories Don't End. It's coming out very, very soon.
Yep, April 9th.
April 9th, right. And what a record. Well, I've only heard one song, and I can already say what a record, because the sound is obviously bigger and elsewhere. The one great thing that I've noticed so far is you guys have done this really great feat of being able to write road records without them sounding like road records. Because so many artists, you get your first album and then you head out on the road, and then the second album nobody can relate to because it's all about road records, you know? But, you know, Time Spent in Los Angeles was a bit like that, and now From a Window Seat even a little bit more. And how does that happen?
Well, I guess, like, you know, I mean, I think like any band, we definitely try to make sure we're not repeating ourselves, you know, like in terms of just what we're talking about. Like there's times where we talk about California or talk about the road, like My Way Back Home or songs like that, where eventually it's like that might be an experience we're still in the thick of, but we try to like carve out different corners of it and figure out how to articulate that. Like From a Window Seat too, it's like we still are on a plane every, it feels like we're on an airplane like every week.
Right.
And it's I think there's a really weird cosmic experience like on a plane where, like, I mean, even if just you're flying into a town that you're familiar with and you're seeing the downtown, you're seeing the outer limits of the town, like all kind of in those last 15 minutes, you see the supermarket you're familiar with. I mean, it's definitely a road song because it has to do with traveling, but it also, I feel like it's sort of, you know, trying to talk about it within our current experience, which is not really what it was when like those classic road songs were written, you know, where it's like, where it is a matter of like, well, we're all in the back of a van without a cell phone, and we're just kind of you know, we're just gonna see what this country has to offer. Now I feel like it's a much more stimulating experience in every sense of the word. So like now being on an airplane, I feel like if you really let yourself go, you could really get caught up in it. It could really like blow your mind a little bit.
Because you don't have that. You have road. You have lots of songs about the road, but not about the airplane. As far as lyrics go, by the way, do you ever get in that point where you're thinking, "Oh God, are the words gonna come?"
Definitely. After our second record, Nothing Is Wrong, I didn't write a song for like 10 months. I mean, 6 of those months were like after the record was the period between the record coming out and the record being finished. So we were just kind of focused on Nothing Is Wrong for so long, but then finally it kind of like, you know, when my head got above water, I was like, well, I haven't written a song in a long time. And so I definitely for a second was like, I hope I write another one.
Yeah.
And then when it did, this was From a Window Seat was actually the first song we wrote for the new album, and then that kind of dictated the direction of the rest.
Well, let's see, the first record was had themes of mortality. The second one was more about growing up and becoming that man. What's that? Because it seems like your digression here is with childhood. But I don't know what.
Yeah, this one, I feel like more than anything, like every song ends up having this thing to it of it's not as simple as I like it to be.
Yeah.
And then each song kind of breaks down into that kind of mindset, I feel like.
And you guys just went to Rwanda.
We sure did.
That's, the pictures are amazing. I can't imagine what that's like. What were you there for?
We were there with a charity called Nothing But Nets, which is basically a charity that's fighting against malaria.
Right.
And we kind of got on board with them when we realized what a brutal killer malaria is around the world. And it was a really life-changing experience to see, because we visited refugee camps, so not only were we learning about malaria as a disease, we were also learning about certain parts of Africa with so much injustice and so much displacement on a profound level. It's really, it'll shake you up. And so now, you know, we're trying to somehow, being expressive musicians, try to help out in whatever we can.
Do you get to that point, though, where you get back and you're going, oh, I was so inspired, and I know that's going to wear off at some point. I know the regular, you know, routine is going to hit back in. How do I keep that up? How do I keep that going?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely stuck with us, and I feel like it's you know, I mean, we all of us here could talk about how cruel the world can be to a group of people here and there, but it's a whole other thing when you're witnessing it firsthand and you're standing right in front of it. And that's something that I don't know if it's possible to shake. I mean, yeah, we've already gotten into our routines, and, like, you know, here we are at South by Southwest after visiting refugee camps. It's definitely quite a juxtaposition, but I feel like that stayed with us. And you know, in terms of why we play music and who we can possibly help, I feel like that's now being shaped by experiences like that.
Well, it's been a great story that's going to end. I cannot wait to hear the rest of this, guys.
2013's Stories Don't End, the subject matter there, but now we get to mix it up actually just a little bit. It was 2012 when I caught up with Dawes for the very first time, and unlike every single time afterwards, it wasn't Taylor Goldsmith, it was bassist Wiley Gelber, and we met backstage at Bonnaroo back in 2012. This was right after their record Nothing Is Wrong had come out. Wiley and I got to talk about that LP, as well as Father John Misty, who had just released his debut album at that time, Part 5. Of Kyle Meredith with Dawes.
How you doing?
I'm well.
This has kind of become a mainstay for you guys.
Yeah, it's awesome. We're stoked to be back here. It's been it's not as hot as last year, so right. We're pretty excited about that.
Right.
Our van melted, like the battery melted last year, broke down 3 times. We got pulled out
is
by
that
a tractor.
True?
Yeah. It was a wild one, but
yeah. Well, yeah. At least you always remember Bonnaroo.
Yeah,
like
exactly.
You can play Coachella, and that's cool, but you know how this story.
Our tour manager got a sunburn that lasted for like 2 weeks, 3 weeks, like purple arm. It was great. Yeah.
So cool. Well, you've had a big year anyway. The record's doing great. The singles have been out there.
Yeah.
I mean, it just to get to a point where you turn around and Dawes is kind of. It seems like you guys are everywhere for a minute.
Yeah, so. We're trying, man. Staying super busy. Been working on a bunch of new songs. Getting those into the set here and there on this little tour, and then probably going to go record it in like October.
Wow.
Yeah.
So it's, I mean, it seems like quick turnaround, but you guys were, I mean, I guess the last record was kind of nearly done by the time like When My Time Comes was taken off and all
that,
right?
Totally. Yeah. That, well, the first record we did and it took so long and we didn't have a label. We made it, we went out on the road with it. And so that one was around for like 2.5 years and we made the second one and now we're kind of like, trying to get back on like the real cycle, like, you know, every year and a half try to put out a new one.
Wow.
Yeah.
And it's funny because a lot of bands were like two or three years, and you're saying like every year you can do that.
I mean,
cool,
you look back at all like the Dylan and the Stones, right? It's like it's sometimes 2 a year, you know what I mean? If you could do it, we'd love to, but at this point we're on the road so much and it's like we really try to squeeze in that like month off to go record. But
it's funny you bring up those names because you've obviously been so embraced by the 70s artists, you know, and that's become a thing for you guys, you know?
Awesome,
I mean, I'm sure you've heard it and heard it and heard it, but modern day the band, you know?
It
just keeps happening, but is there going to be more of those? Do you guys have more of those planned?
Hopefully. I mean, we're doing more shows with Jackson. We're doing Newport with him, so we'll be his band for that. And then otherwise, I mean, it's getting harder and harder just because we keep getting busy on our own stuff, but I mean, we always love to. It's like one of the joys of our life is like having him been able to play with
how
all those guys.
Yeah, awesome.
So yeah, it's crazy.
Tell me about Father John Misty. I have fell in love with this record. Fear Fun blew me away, and I had no clue you were part of it first.
Yeah.
I'm just going through it day and night, and suddenly I start reading the liner notes because they're fantastic. I
mean, the liner notes
cover
are
art.
Crazy. Yeah. It's awesome.
And there you are.
Yeah, well, he's good. I mean, I was like the assistant engineer, and then I played bass on maybe like 4 or 5 of them, and we did it with the same producer that did both of our records, Jonathan Wilson. Did it at his house, and I was just in town, so I got to hang out and do it, and I mean, the record sounds amazing. I think it sounds great. Taylor loves it. He listens to it every day.
You guys taking any dance move lessons from Tillman?
I mean, not yet. I don't know if I'm ready for him. But, yeah, he's a badass.
Man. Well, he shows what he shows is lanky guys like us, shouldn't be afraid of moving.
Yeah, we can still do it. Yeah,
and as much as I want to say, I can't even do that by myself in front of a mirror.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
He's good, man.
Does he do that in the studio?
Yeah, he's pretty much what you see is what you get. He's the real deal, man.
That's awesome. Yeah. So as far as your guys' new record, is there a direction yet? Are you guys looking at it? Is this tried and true Dawes?
I mean, we're trying to make sure that it gets to... I mean, we don't want to keep putting out records that obviously are just, new batch of songs, mm-hmm. same record. Mm-hmm. So we're trying to definitely, expand the horizons for ourselves, and for what people want to hear, but still, maintain, obviously the parts that people like about the band. But definitely try to meld it a little bit more with the live show and it should be cool.
Well, that's always been a thing too. It's like your live show and your albums have been, that's two different speeds, but two different emotions usually. And it's always kind of been a curiosity. Could you guys do that on record?
Yeah, I mean, in the first record, it was a very conscious decision. Was we were listening to how you hear an old Neil Young record and it's so mellow and intimate, or a band record
right.
the Brown album. And it's so quiet, and then you watch The Last Waltz, and it's a huge production, And so at first we were that was a thing that we were attracted to, is go hear the record in your room, listen to it, really get into the songs, and then go see it live, and it's a performance, you know what I mean?
Right.
And then the second record, we tried to kind of split the difference, and then this one I think we'll probably even try to split it more so,
Awesome. Yeah. Well, I'm looking forward to it, man. It's been fun watching you guys grow this whole time, watching the world embrace you.
Thanks, man.
So good luck on 2012 and your Bonnaroo set today.
Thanks a lot.
Cool. All right, see you around.
All right, see you later.
Cool.
Back at Bonnaroo in 2012, talking about that record, Nothing Is Wrong, Wiley Gelber of Dawes right there. And then one more to throw in here. This is sort of an asterisk, a bonus. Now head back to 2011, just a year before that Nothing Is Wrong. Taylor and I had jumped on the phone not to talk about Dawes so much, but to talk about Middle Brother, a side project he had put together with Deer Ticks' John McCauley and Delta Spirits' Matthew Logan Vasquez. Part 6 of Kyle Meredith with Dawes. And just from the start, the obvious spot, what was it that that brought you all together?
It started with me, Matt, and Delta Spirit. They took Dawes out on our first tour because we were all close friends from previous bands. That was kind of us starting tours through them, and we always stayed close because of that. And then after that, six or seven months later, we went on tour with Deer Tick. We didn't know them before, and they were really awesome to us. And John and I had a we got along, we became close friends really quickly. And at the end of the tour, he was like, we should get together and make a record together. I said, sure, but I didn't really think that it would happen because I feel like that stuff never happens with that sort of thing. I think there's a lot of people that say, we should totally get together and write some songs and record them, but no one ever does. So I just kind of put it out of mind. And then a couple months later, he called me and said, so I took February off and I'm ready to do it. And I want us to get together. And if you can come, let's do this. Let's make this record. And so that was the beginning of that. And once I got there, Matt called me and was like, hey, I heard about your project with John from Deer Tick. I'm not doing anything this month, and I'd love to come and be a part of it if you guys want to do that. And so I told John, I was like, well, Matt, that guest from Double Spirit wants to come down and sing with us. And at the time, we didn't really know. At the time, they hadn't been friends. They never met, really.
Mm-hmm.
But John is a really nice guy, and John was just immediately let's have him down here. I don't care. Let's see. And we didn't really know what the nature of it was going to be because we didn't know if we were going to get, four songs recorded or no songs recorded or we didn't know what it was going to end up being. And so Matt got down there, and we didn't know if he was just going to be on, one or two songs or if he was going to be involved in everything. And pretty immediately, we all just started, Matt and I had a history. But John and him really got along great, too, and they started after that. Matt was involved with every song, and that was kind of how we recorded them. And we ended up recording 22 songs.
The writing process. I mean, you've got a lot of people in there. Did you come in with prepared material, or did it really all happen organically?
A lot of the stuff just happened there. There were some songs, Me 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 and A Million Dollar Bill and Thanks for Nothing, that were written there, and more than that, even there was also some stuff that from previous stuff from the band. I know that like Matt's songs, like they were ideas that Delta Spirit hadn't really rounded out quite yet, and then same with like Daydreaming. Daydreaming was a brand new song of John's, which, like, he hadn't played with Deer Tick yet, and it just made more sense for the Little Brother thing than Deer Tick.
Now, with it being three vocalists, did you guys have trouble sorting things out? Was there any process of actually stepping on each other's feet when you're trying to figure it all out?
Not really. I mean, like, each song is sung by the guy that wrote it, pretty much, other than like one song that I wrote called Million Dollar Bill, where we all take a verse. Uh-huh. But no, it was pretty simple. Like, we're all easygoing guys, and if there's a song, like, oh, here's the harmony parts, like, you know, any of us could sing like whatever notes, I could sing high or low as necessary. So it was sort of like, he'll sing the lead, and like, you want to take this harmony or this harmony, and everyone, it just couldn't have gone more smoothly.
Yeah.
And then we're also all playing the instruments, like, pretty much on all of it, other than drums. On drums is my brother Griffin Goldsmith from Dawes. He flew in for, I think he was only there for like 4 days, but he was able to get all the drums done in that fast. And otherwise, like, bass, piano, all the guitars is all the three of us.
Now in my head, and I know I'm totally romanticizing this whole ordeal, but knowing a little bit about each of you, and mostly about John, he's a good partier, John is.
Oh, yeah.
So in my head, this is a Lost Weekend style Lennon Rolling Stones thing.
Right, right.
But you guys remember.
I mean, it was funny, because I, you know, in a very unexciting way, am kind of the exact opposite of that.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a really unique relationship, and we still do, and it's like the Odd Couple or something, where, like, I couldn't be more in love with John. He's one of my best friends, one of my favorite people in the world, and I know that we get along. I know that he, you know, might feel the same, but it is funny how, like, he'll come into town in L.A. or something, or even when we were in Nashville making the record, it's like it'll get to be 2 a.m. and the bars are closing, and, like, I have a fair amount to drink myself, but he'll just be like, okay, where to next, everybody? And it's like, geez Louise, like, I have to go home. So, like, our schedules would often just, like, not match up, because he'd be waking up in the middle of the afternoon, and, like, I would have been up for 5 hours already. And so, like, but once we started working together, it just couldn't have gone more smoothly.
So, without having heard any of the record besides the single, and I haven't let myself listen to the live clips yet, the direction, did you guys have any plan of a direction? You said you brought all of your songs in, and with Me, 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 I mean, there's a bit of a throwback there, almost a retro thing going there. Did there end up being a theme as far as the sound for the record that evolved?
I mean, like, not really. Like, when you hear the record, it's definitely, like, it has qualities of Dawes, Delta, and Deer Tick, like, that you can definitely point out. But it also, it has, like, an immediacy. Like, I think that with every single song, Me, Me, Me being, like, you know, the same going for Me, 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 is just that we play them in the, with the immediate arrangement that came to mind. And a lot of, like, you know, the Little Richard yells and, like, stuff like that, like that's just, like, one guy was in the studio and he just sang it, and then we all just kind of went along with it. And the drum parts and the guitar parts, the piano part and stuff, like, that was all just, like that song was recorded, like, you know, for 3 hours one day of the whole experience. So it was, like, nothing was dwelled upon, and everything was sort of committed to immediately, and we just went with it. And that's how the whole record was made. And I like to think that you can hear that on the whole record. Like, when you listen to it, you're like, wow, this sounds like these guys are, like, you know, playing the song for the first time, because it's actually what's going on. Mm-hmm.
You're going to tour, too. You're going to tour behind this, and it looks like you're matching yourselves up with your day job bands as well.
Yeah, yeah. And that was kind of the whole purpose for the whole project, because, like, the reality of it is, you know, we're not established as the guys that might make up other, like, combination groups, like, or collaborative groups, like, you know, Broken Bells or Monsters of Folk. Like, mm-hmm. I feel like we're all the young guys that haven't sold as many records as those guys. So when you're in a situation like that, I think it could be a little bit, like, we can't afford to take time off from you know, the Dawes and Deer Ticks the same way Jim James might be able to afford taking a significant amount of time off from My Morning Jacket, because he knows the fans will be there when he gets back. Whereas that wouldn't be the case for us young bands, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so with this, like, from the very beginning, it was like, this is for Dawes and Deer Tick and Delta Spirit. Like, this is the purpose of this is to help us. And if it doesn't do that, if it like overshadows it or anything like that, then the idea of the project like is backfired. Like along that line of thinking, we were like, if that's what this is for, and if Middle Brother isn't really like a band necessarily, but more of just like a record that was made amongst friends, we want to make sure that we get to put our best foot forward. And you know, if a bunch of Deer Tick fans are coming because they know that John's a part of this, or if a bunch of Delta fans are coming because they know Matt's a part of it, we also want to make sure that people know what we really do and we really put all our time towards, which is, you know, our individual bands, rather than have just a Middle Brother tour where we have to take time off from our respective bands. We figure, like, why don't we all just go out together?
So you get your stamina up, though, because this means you're going to be doing two sets per night, right?
Oh, yeah, which isn't actually, like, that new for us. Like, we went out with Jason Bozell, and we were his backing band, and we're about to go out with John and Corndog, and we're going to be his backing band. Like, we love bringing out guys that we can also play with, and it was like when we first found out about the Middle Brother tour, I half jokingly, but also if they would let me, I would definitely do it. I told Matt and I told the Deer Tick guys, I was like, if you let me play, like, if you just say the word, I'll play guitar in your whole set, and I just won't leave the stage all night.
I know you're only halfway through the experience now, but could you see yourself doing this again, though? Could there be a future for Middle Brother, or is this just that one-time thing?
Well, I mean, I love Matt and John, and I'd love to do it again. I mean, we have no plans to do it because we all have like other stuff coming up, but I'm really proud of the work that we did, and it couldn't have been an easier process in terms of making the record. It really came along at a good time for me with Dawes, because like we just really were free and we were able to, and now like I don't see another month like that being available for a second, I'm excited to see how the tour goes, and I'm excited to see how, you know, people respond to it, and you know, I'd love to continue making music with those guys.
Well, I'm looking forward to hearing the rest of the Middle Brother record. I'm definitely looking forward to hearing the next Dawes record.
Thanks.
All right, man. Well, thanks so much. And, yeah, good luck out there. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, man. Talk to you soon.
All right, bye. Taylor Goldsmith back in 2011 talking about that self-titled Middle Brother album. And that does it. I have no more Taylor Goldsmith interviews in the tank that I'm aware of, unless I missed one. I think that's all of them. That's enough for today, just the same. Thanks to Taylor and all of Dawes and Middle Brother as well for all the years of interviews so far. Here's to 10 more. And hey, before you get out of here, you've made it this far. If you're not already a subscriber, you've got no excuses. Hit that subscribe button wherever you're listening from right now, wherever you get your favorite podcast from. That includes iTunes and Apple Podcast and Spotify and YouTube. You can do it over there as well. And then head over to WFPK.org, where I do a show every Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern, where you can hear the brand new songs, you can hear anniversary celebrations, clips from these interviews, music news, and a whole lot more. That's at WFPK.org. Consequence of Sound has your music and film news. You can also find me at Twitter at Kyle Meredith and Facebook /Kyle Meredith. And that does it for another edition. I'm Kyle Meredith. I'll see you next time.
Consequence Podcast Network.